This morning, I have prepared a sermon from the book of Ecclesiastes, and I have called it The Perspective of Wisdom. The Perspective of Wisdom. You know, Ecclesiastes is a powerful book about wisdom. But the wisdom of Ecclesiastes has a little bit of a different flavor than the wisdom of the book of Proverbs, for instance. And it doesn't contradict it. It's not like it's at odds with it. There are no thoughts in Ecclesiastes that are opposed to the thoughts of a book like Proverbs. In fact, Ecclesiastes and the wisdom of Ecclesiastes complements the wisdom of Proverbs very well. But here's what I mean. Proverbs is really all about practical wisdom, thinking about life in terms of cause and effect. That if you are able to see the outcome of a choice before you make it, well, then typically you can make better choices. And generally, your life will go better if you make wise choices than if you make foolish ones. And the wisdom of Proverbs is not always absolute. There are some times where a principle is taught where there are exceptions to that principle. You know, sometimes you do all the right things and you still don't get the desired outcome that you wanted. But generally, if we're able to see the end of a path from the beginning, we can make better choices. And so if you work hard, you'll generally make more money. If you tell the truth, you'll generally have better relationships. If you learn to keep your mouth shut when you get angry, generally, you'll avoid saying things that you regret. That's the way Proverbs is written. And so it's very practical. But Ecclesiastes takes a step back. And instead of looking at every individual aspect of life, Ecclesiastes asks the question, yes, but what is it all about? Does wisdom actually accomplish anything? Is life even really worth living? Why do our lives even matter? And as you look in the book of Ecclesiastes, you see that the perspective is from somebody who calls himself the preacher in Ecclesiastes 1 in verse 1. In Hebrew, it's the word koheleth. And it means the teacher or the one who has called together an assembly of people to hear the message that he's presenting. In fact, the title of the book, Ecclesiastes, comes from the Greek translation of that word, koheleth. And it's the word ekklesia, the word church. And so the idea is that the preacher has called together a group of people to deliver this message and to help them to understand something about the meaning of life. And I'll just warn you that as the preacher works through these thoughts, he goes to some pretty dark places. There are a lot of people who really have come to appreciate the book of Proverbs. Even people who are not really religious can understand the wisdom of Proverbs to a certain extent. But the first time that you read Ecclesiastes, you might end up feeling a little bit depressed. You might feel a little bit unnerved by some of the dark places that the book goes to. You might start to feel overwhelmed with existential dread. And I think that's the point. I think that the teacher is saying, look, you can't live your life well unless you come face to face with your existential crisis. Unless you understand what all of life is like and what all of life is about, then none of it makes any sense at all. So it's like he grabs us by the scruff of our neck and forces us to stare eye to eye with our existential dread, because it's only then that we can know how to live. And so this sermon is titled The Perspective of Wisdom, and I've summarized the book of Ecclesiastes with 3 points that I think the preacher presents to help us have the best perspective on the meaning of life. And the first is that life under the sun is vanity. Let's begin by reading the very famous introduction of this book. It's Ecclesiastes 1, verses 1 through 11. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Verse 2 says, vanity of vanities. He repeats that phrase again, vanity of vanities, and then he concludes, all is vanity. That's a pretty emphatic statement. It's like the preacher wants us to know right up front, this is what I'm saying, and I want you to make sure that you understand it. Everything is vanity. And this phrase, vanity of vanities, it's a Hebrew idiom. It's very similar to like the idiom holy of holies or king of kings. In Hebrew, it's a way to underscore the degree of the word that's being discussed. And so like the holy of holies is the most holy place, or the king of kings is the most kingly king. He's king over all kings. Vanity of vanities means life is utterly vanity. Utterly vanity. And the word vanity in Hebrew is the word habel. And literally it means vapor or breath. And so what the preacher is wanting us to understand is that despite how meaningful this life might seem, and despite how weighty all of life can feel, and despite how important the pursuits in your life might be to you, at the end of the day, it's all just sort of like smoke. You try to find some meaning and some purpose in it, and as soon as you grab onto it, it just slips through your fingers. And the meaning is hard to hold on to. There's no real substance. And so he asks the question in verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And the most important word in that question might be the word all in verse 3. He's not asking you, what do you gain by working a year at your job? You can put a number on that. Or what do you gain by going out in your yard and, you know, doing some landscaping? I mean, you can quantify that to a certain extent. No, the preacher wants us to ask the question, what is it all about? What is the entirety of your life about? What do you gain for all the toil, all the work that you do under the sun? And the phrase under the sun is a phrase that's unique to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's used 29 times in this book and nowhere else in the Bible. And so that tells us that that phrase is pretty important to our understanding of the meaning of the book. And the phrase under the sun simply refers to what happens on the earth. You know, if you are under the sun, you are on the earth. And that's the idea. All of your toil on the earth, what does it amount to? And so what the preacher is doing is he's analyzing this life as if it's all that we have. And he tells us his conclusion up front. It's vanity. He says, generations come and go. And have you ever noticed that the earth doesn't even seem to notice? You know, like you could go climb a mountain and the mountain isn't really going to care that you climbed it. And 100 years from now, there's probably not even going to be anybody who knows that you climbed it, and the mountain will still be there, just hanging out, doing its thing. Winds blow, Rivers run, but do they ever accomplish any purpose? The streams keep flowing and flowing, but the sea never reaches a full capacity. The world itself testifies to its own vanity. And the question is, if your entire life is only a minuscule blip in the vain history of a vain world, why does it matter at all? I warned you, there's some existential dread here. It gets dark. But look at his reaction to all of this in chapter 2. Look in chapter 2 in verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. You see what he's saying right there? He's saying, look, I know Proverbs is true. Like, I see it. And I wrote it, don't forget. You know, Solomon's the same guy. But like, Solomon is saying, look, wisdom works. It's beneficial. It's useful for life. But what's it all about? Verse 15. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. You know, there's a philosophical term for this kind of perspective of life. And the term for it is nihilism. Solomon is describing the perspective of nihilism. Webster's dictionary defines nihilism as a viewpoint that traditional values and beliefs are unfounded and that existence is senseless and useless. And you know, if you begin with the premise that this life is all that there is, that's what Solomon is doing here. That's what the preacher is doing here. He's saying, look, you want to pretend like this life is all that there is? Fine, let's start there. The logical conclusion, it's nihilism. Nothing matters. Nothing matters. Why try at all? Why get a job? Why get an education? Why do or become anything? Why have relationships? Why care about morality? If everything is just going to be washed away by the sands of time, nothing matters. There's no good, there's no evil, there's no right, there's no wrong. 100 years from now, nobody's even going to know what you did. You know, I have very faint memories of a few of my great-grandparents. But not all of them. I don't know if I could even tell you the names of my great-great-grandparents. And Solomon's point is, how long will it be before you're forgotten? How long will it be before everything that you've done, everything that you are, is just totally erased by time? It's not as long as you think. And 1,000 years from now, people might not even be able to read the name on your headstone. If all of life, if this life is all that there is, nothing matters. And let me show you just how dark his thoughts get. In Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 2, "And I thought the dead, who are already dead, more fortunate than the living, who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun." If this life is all that there is, the only logical response is nihilism. That life is utterly pointless. Now here's the thing. That's logical, but there's not a lot of people who live that way. I mean, do you know anybody who really acts like their life is totally pointless, totally meaningless? You know, like they just don't even bother to get out of bed and they just lay there. I mean, sometimes people get to a point like that, and that's extreme depression. That's a mental issue that needs to be dealt with. See, most of us get up in the morning, and eventually we find some reason to get a shower and to get dressed and to go to work and to do the things that we do, and we're even able to find some pleasure in all of it. Some of us like our jobs. Some of us like our landscaping, yard work. Some of us like the things that we do. But the question is why? And that leads to the second major point in Ecclesiastes. And that is, ignoring the vanity of life doesn't make it satisfying. You know, there are a lot of people who live their lives as what we might call optimistic agnostics. Optimistic agnostics. You know, it's this idea of, you know, I don't really know what happens when we die. I don't know if there's a God. I don't know what it's all about in the end, but I know that I have this life right now, and I'm going to enjoy it for what it is. And Solomon is wanting us to see that that's foolish. It's foolish. It's intellectually dishonest is what it is. But somebody says, look, I enjoy my job. I enjoy my vacations. I enjoy eating strawberry ice cream. And I like listening to bluegrass music. And I like coaching my son's baseball team. And I'm not going to let you ruin my life with all of this talk about the vanity of life. You can't take that from me. I'm just fine with my life exactly as it is. But see, what Ecclesiastes forces us to do is to ask the question, why? Why is your life meaningful? Why is your life enjoyable if this life is all that there is? Because what we'll see is that he agrees that life can be enjoyed, but he knows that you can't truly enjoy it without a satisfying reason. Look at what he says as we continue here in chapter 2. In verse 24, he says, "There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind." See, now we're starting to circle around the point of this book. And that's the way that I think this book is written. Is that the writer is just sort of working through some thoughts in a circular way, and he gets closer and closer to nailing the point of it all, and he finally gets there in chapter 12. But this is one of those times where he's circling the perspective of life. And he's saying, look, if somebody says, well, I enjoy going on vacation, the question is why? Why do you enjoy that? And somebody might say, well, because it makes me feel happy. It makes me feel relaxed, and you know, my batteries are recharged, and I can go back to work and I can be more productive at work. Well, why does that matter? Well, so that I can make more money and go on more vacations. Solomon is forcing us to analyze the whole thing, not just a piece of it. What's it all about? What's the entire point of it? And if this life is all that we have, it's impossible to be intellectually honest and truly enjoy it. No matter what you attach meaning to in this life, it'll always be unsatisfying. He calls it striving or grasping after the wind. The idea is that when you grab onto it, it just dissolves. Strawberry ice cream melts in your mouth. It goes down your throat, and then it's gone. What was the point? You know, you're making a difference at your job. That's great. You're making a difference there. How long do you think that that difference will last? How long do you think people will even remember you once you retire? It's probably not as long as you think. You enjoy your family. That's great. You know, one day your kids will grow up and move away. One day your spouse will die. Your kids will die too. What was it all for? Was it just so that they could go off and raise kids who will die one day too? See, I know this is dark. I know it's dark. But that's what he's wanting us to confront, is the darkness that we live in, the darkness that we fail to acknowledge, the darkness that we're too afraid to confront. It's the existential dread of what is life all about? What's the point? And if we try to find meaning and purpose and satisfaction under the sun alone, we will never be able to do it. And so if nothing matters in the end, our only choice is to either live with no purpose or to keep trying to find meaning in what's meaningless. We'll bounce back and forth between nihilism and grasping after the wind. And what the preacher wants us to understand is that this is by God's design. He wants us to come to terms with the emptiness of life under the sun, because that will drive us towards the only thing that does satisfy. Bruce read for us from Romans 8 at the beginning of services. And in Romans 8 and verse 20, it tells us the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. When sin entered the world and mankind was cursed because of sin, the earth was also cursed. The creation was cursed. And it was meant to show us that there must be something more. God let the creation fall into futility in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. You see, deep down, there's a part of all of us that knows that temporary things will always fall short. No matter how good the strawberry ice cream is, it will not satisfy your deepest longings. It can't heal a broken heart. It doesn't comfort an aching soul. No amount of achievement would be enough to do that. No amount of money would be enough to do that. And even if you have the best relationships imaginable, there's a part of you that will not be satisfied with relationships that have to end. See? And so look at what he observes in chapter 3, in verse 9. He says, "What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end." What does it mean that God has put eternity into our hearts? You know, human beings are the only creatures who have existential crises. You know, I don't think that your dog ever has thoughts like this. Your dog does not lay in bed awake at night wondering, what's my life really about, you know? Your dog isn't sitting there thinking like, why am I here? What's it all for? That's a uniquely human problem. Because humans have been made in a unique way in the image of an eternal God. Among all the creation, we have a unique longing for eternal purpose. Your dog is as satisfied as he'll ever be when you toss him a scrap of meat from the table. That's it. Like, that's 100% happiness, total satisfaction in the life of a dog. But you and I long for something more. And we can deny it. We can pretend that we don't. We can try to drown our longings with temporary things. But if we're honest with ourselves, we know that it'll never be enough. And so existential dread is a gift from God. It's meant to drive us towards what will really satisfy. There's a book by a man named Sheldon Vonnegut. It's called A Severe Mercy. And it's an autobiographical account of the author's relationship with his wife and how he ends up processing her untimely death. And he and his wife were both personal friends of C.S. Lewis. And in this book, he includes 18 letters that C.S. Lewis wrote to him. I would just like to read an excerpt. He says, C.S. Lewis, in his second letter to me at Oxford, asked how it was that I, as a product of a materialistic universe, was not at home there. Do fish complain of the sea for being wet? Or if they did, would that fact itself not strongly suggest that they had not always been or would not always be purely aquatic creatures? Then, if we complain of time and take such joy in the seemingly timeless moment, what does that suggest? It suggests that we have not always been or will not always be purely temporal creatures. It suggests that we were created for eternity. Not only are we harried by time, we seem unable, despite 1,000 generations, even to get used to it. We are always amazed by it, how fast it goes, how slowly it goes, how much of it is gone. Where, we cry, has the time gone? We aren't adapted to it, not at home in it. If that is so, it may appear as a proof or at least a powerful suggestion that eternity exists and is our home. You see the point? The fish is made for the water, and so the fish never thinks about how life would be better if he could escape the water. But the fact that we long to be free from the corruption of this place, from the bounds of time, from all that the sands of time take away from us, it suggests very strongly that we were made for an eternal purpose. That's what we've been designed for. And it's because God has put eternity into our hearts. The eternal God has made us in his image. And so that brings us to the third and final point. That making peace with the vanity of life is actually what makes us free to enjoy it. Let's keep reading here in chapter 3. Look at verses 12 and 13. He says, I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. You see, what the writer of Ecclesiastes keeps doing is he keeps going back and forth between saying, life is utterly meaningless. Life is utterly pointless. If you try to find meaning and purpose in this life, you're always going to be frustrated. You're never going to be satisfied. But I guess what you should really do is just enjoy life for what it is. And for all of these dark places of existential dread that he drags us to, the message of Ecclesiastes about the meaning of life is a very bright message. He says you should enjoy life. You should take pleasure in it. But if you want to be able to do that, you have to stop trying to make this life into something that it's not. Let me give you a couple of examples. It's kind of like getting mad at your toaster if it doesn't do a good job making scrambled eggs. I don't know if anybody here has tried to make scrambled eggs in a toaster. Personally, I haven't. I just suspect that wouldn't work really well, you know. And you crack some eggs, put them in a bowl, stir them up, and then pour that little slurry into your toaster and hope scrambled eggs comes out. That's probably going to make a mess. It's going to smell bad. You're not going to be satisfied with the results. And so, like, maybe you try to do it a different way. Like, I don't know, maybe you could lay the toaster sideways and sling some eggs into it. I mean, but no matter how you do it, it's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. But then you might discover that you have this nifty device called a frying pan. And man, that makes really good scrambled eggs. And if you can make good scrambled eggs with your frying pan, you might also discover that the toaster is pretty good at making something else, toast. And toast goes pretty good with scrambled eggs. See? When we stop trying to find our ultimate satisfaction in this life, we might also discover that this life can be pretty enjoyable. When we have our longing for eternity satisfied by eternal things, well, then we are free to enjoy temporal things as temporal things. We're not trying to make this life be something that it's not. Let me use another metaphor, if you'll humor me for a moment. This perspective of life turns life from a court case into a tea party. I want you to imagine that you are being tried for murder. It doesn't really make any difference whether you're guilty or not. Just imagine that you're on trial for murder. How do you think you would feel if you knew that you were on trial for murder? You think you might feel anxious? You might feel stressed. You might lay awake at night, not able to sleep because you're so worried about what's going to happen to you. You'd be desperately trying to prove yourself. You would want to acquire as much evidence as you could and present it to the jury to make a case for yourself, to plead for your life. You know, that's the way a lot of people live life. It's just like that. Stressed, anxious, worried, hoping to prove that they matter, hoping to prove that there's some meaning in their life, some reason for their existence. But what about if your four-year-old invites you to her tea party? Your four-year-old comes to you and says, "Hey, I'm having a tea party later today. Will you come?" Do you get really like anxious about that? Like, oh man, what am I going to wear? I hope I don't embarrass myself. You know, there's a lot riding on this, and you fret about it all. No, you don't do that. You're able to just go and enjoy it. And it doesn't matter that there's not actually tea in the cup. You know, you sit there with your pinky up, and you just smile and have a good time. You want to be there, but you know that the stakes just really aren't that high. And so you're free to enjoy the simple pleasure for what it is. See, when we gain the right perspective of this life, we gain the freedom to really enjoy it for what it is. And so again, for a book that deals with the darkest parts of our existential dread, Ecclesiastes ends up with a pretty bright perspective on life. Some of my favorite verses are here in chapter 9. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 7. "Go, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white, let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love, all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going." The preacher says, go enjoy life, live well, eat the strawberry ice cream, take long walks on the beach, hug your children, love your wife, play some music, brush your hair, do your work, find the joy in this life while you can. But the only people who can truly live like that are the ones who have learned to hold it all with an open hand, because they have the satisfaction of their deepest longings secured in eternity. In chapter 11, in verse 7, he says, "Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun." So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. It's a bit of a paradox, isn't it? That the more that we try to find satisfaction in this life, the less satisfied we'll be. But the sooner that we come to find our satisfaction in our relationship with God, the more enjoyable that this life becomes. And the preacher wants us to grapple with these things when we're young, so that we don't waste our lives grasping at the wind. Well, you know the conclusion to this book, don't you? In chapter 12 and verse 13, he says, "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil." You see, the writer of this book wants us to consider what the entirety of life is about. Over and over again, he's asking, what is it all for? What is it all for? And the purpose of my life and your life is to fear God and keep his commandments. That's the whole duty of man. That's the way to find meaning and satisfaction. That's the way to be fulfilled. That's the way to be able to enjoy this life for what it is, because you have your hope secure in somewhere beyond the sun. You and I were made in the image of an eternal God. And if you and I want to be what we were made to be, there's no other way than to find our satisfaction in him. You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus essentially summarizes the entire book of Ecclesiastes in Matthew 6. He asked the question in verse 25. He says, "Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life." That's your life under the sun. Don't be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, or about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? This life and the purpose of it and the satisfaction of it is about more than the things of this life. It's more than that. And so he says in verse 33, "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." You make peace with the vanity of this life by having an eternal purpose in doing the will of God, and then you're free to enjoy this life for what it is. You can try to find meaning and satisfaction here. You can try to define and derive some purpose for yourself in the things of this life. And Solomon wants us to know that that's foolishness. But when your hope is firmly planted beyond the sun, then you can enjoy life under the sun as God has designed it to be enjoyed. There might be somebody here who realizes that your hopes have been misplaced. Maybe you've been trying to find some meaning and some purpose under the sun. And maybe Solomon or the preacher has taken you by the scruff of the neck and forced you to come to terms with the foolishness of the way that you've been living. If you want to have an inheritance in heaven, you can have that by becoming a child of God, by being united with Christ in his death and in his resurrection. And if we can help you in some way, we invite you to come to the front and let us know while we stand together and sing.